Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Chav Dalet, chapter 24 of Melachim Bet, the second to last chapter of the Sefer. And this Perek opens up with an example of something that I haven't spent a lot of time noticing, but that is always worth paying attention to, in that the traditional separation of the text differs as to where the story begins or ends from the chapter divisions that we commonly use, but which are generally assumed to have been done by non-Jews. So in our case, Pasuk Lamed Vav of the previous Perek starts the story of Jehoiakim's kingdom, that he was 25 when he came to rule, and he ruled for 11 years, etc., and that he had done evil, and then continues from there. So that in the traditional reading, what we're starting today with Pasuk Aleph is really just a continuation of the story of Jehoiakim's kingdom. The chapter dividers, however, assume that this issue of Pasuk Aleph, B'yamav Allah Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Vahilo Jehoiakim Eved... Vahilo Yehoyakim Eved Shalosh Shanim Vayasho Vayim Rodbo is the beginning of the chapter, that in the days of Yehoyakim, Nebuchadnezzar came to the southern kingdom, and Yehoyakim was served him for 3 years, and then he returned and he rebelled against him. So the Radak points out that there are difficulties if you try to compare Yehoyakim's story to the various places it appears in Tanakh. In Daniel it appears, and Divrei Yomim it appears. So first, we're going to find out that in Pasuk Vav that he dies, and it sounds like he dies in bed, but it's not true. He gets dragged in the dirt by Nebuchadnezzar, and he dies while being dragged along behind some chariots. So that, and the Radak assumes, based on the various chronology issues, that he served Nebuchadnezzar for 3 years after he came back, that he had already become king for a while. Then Nebuchadnezzar took him captive first, and then after 3 years of having him captive, he then released him, and then he brought him back, and then after that Jehoiakim again rebelled against him, and that was when finally his kingdom came to an end. So there's a whole complicated thing. It seems like Jehoiakim's reign was one filled, punctuated by problems in terms of independence and autonomy. Lots of armies come against them now. All the surrounding nations, and they join Nebuchadnezzar in destroying and coming to destroy the southern kingdom. And the Radak says a theme that will come up again in this parak, Shenatan Hashem Belibam Lavo. The Fisha Sahara Mini Hashem. That wasn't a direct quote, but that Hashem put it in their hearts to come. So it's not so much that Nebuchadnezzar commanded them to come, as Nebuchadnezzar tried to create what we today would call a coalition of the willing, and they all decided to join, and that the reason why God would give it in their hearts to join is because of all the evil that the people of Yehudah have done. And the reason why the Radak says that Hashem made it is because the end of the pasuk, Kidvar Hashem asher diber biyad avadav hanavim, as Hashem had spoken about in the hands of his prophets, of his servants, the prophets. Pasuk Gimel Achal Pi Hashem Haita B'Yehuda. It was by the mouth of Hashem, meaning it was the decree of Hashem that this happened. Lahasir Me'al Panav, to remove them from his face. Bechatot Menasheh Kechol Asher Asa, because of all the sins that Menasheh had done. So the Radak understands this to mean that it was in Menasheh's time that the decree had been made to have this happen, and now it's happening. So the idea of Hashem putting into people's hearts is one to think about, because we generally believe, we have a firm and strong belief, the Rambam calls it one of the foundations of the faith. He doesn't mean of it as an ikar hadat, but it's a basis, the foundation upon which our faith relies, and it's sort of part of the belief in reward and punishment, is that we have free will, and that's why there is such a thing as reward and punishment. One can lose free will. So it could be the answer is just that from the time of Menashe, some level of free will was lost. We pointed out other possibilities. It could be that for all that Hashem made Gzeira, the Gzeira could have been delayed and delayed, and then who knows what might have happened with it. But these other nations coming seems to be not fully volitional on their part. Or it could be that they would have wanted to anyway, and it just fit in well with the decree of Hashem. That whole idea of when Hashem predicts that something will happen, that people will do something, and that it does, the question of how free will works in there is a complicated one. Here, the Radak seems to think that Hashem is really putting it into their hearts in an active way, which would imply that they also lost their free will and became the tools of Hashem. Then that would presume that they couldn't be rewarded or punished for that, since Hashem is controlling them in that way. We'll see this more at the end of the parak, so let's just go on for a second. Pasuk Dalet, V'gam dam ha'naki asher shafach v'amalei Yerushalayim dam naki v'lo avah Hashem lishloach. A review of Menashe's sins, that also we remember that he had filled Yerushalayim with dam naki, with innocent blood, and Hashem did not choose to forgive. So remember that dam naki might have been Yeshayahu the prophet, or it might have been just in general that he killed innocent people, and Hashem didn't choose to forgive. Always worth remembering as to how much pressure there was on Hashem to forgive. There was the time of Yoshio. There was the end of Menashe's time. There was time of Yoshio. And other than that, it seems like there wasn't much pressure on Hashem that Hashem would need to forgive, that the people did the right thing so much. And the rest of what Yehoyakim did is written in the history books of the Malchei Yehuda. So Yehoyakim dies, and Yehoyakim takes the throne. Pasuk Zayin notes that at this point, because recently Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, had been taking an active role in affairs in Malchut Yehuda, so that when Yoshiyahu had died, Yehoahaz had been made king. He only ruled for 3 months. And then Parnacho dethroned him, and he put Yehoyakim on the throne. And then all of a sudden we see that Yehoyakim is having problems with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel. So the Pasuk pauses to let us know that in fact is an accurate reflection of the political currents of the time. That the king of Mitzrayim had gone down in power, had lost power, and he had stopped, at least at that time period, he had stopped leaving his land to help the Jews. Why? Because the king of Bavel had conquered all of that. So that's sort of an insight to Yehoyakim's time. Even though Yehoyakim had been put on the throne by Paro Necho, by the king of Egypt, that support and that source of his rule, that basis for his, that foundation for his position, had been lost because the king of Egypt had lost the ability to fight those wars. He was now inferior in power to the king of Bavel. So Bozeket, ben shmoneh esrei shana Yehoyachin b'malcho. He's 18 when he takes over. Yehoyachin is now the son of Yehoyakim. U'shlosha chadashim alach b'Yerushalayim. He rules for 3 months. V'shem isha imo nechushta vat el natan mi'Yerushalayim. That's her name. She is nechushta, the daughter of el natan. V'yas ha'ra b'nei Hashem k'chol asher ha'saviv. He follows his father's ways and he does what's evil. V'aytahi alu avdei Nebuchadnezzar. In his time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel Yerushalayim, the king of Bavel, came to Yerushalayim, Atavoyer Bamatzor, and the city is once again under siege. Vayavod Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel Ahair, and he comes himself on the city to attack the city. Vavadav Tzoy Maleha, and his servants are laying siege. Vayetze Yehoyachin Melech Yehuda al Melech Bavel, Hu v'imo v'avadav v'sarav v'sarisav. So Yehoyachin takes a delegation out to meet the king of Bavel, him and his mother and his close servants and his officers, and his sarisim could be his literal eunuchs, or sarisim could be just other of his officers and ministers. And they surrender to the king of Bavel, and the king of Bavel takes them. In the 8th year, in the 8th year of his, meaning the king of Bavel's reign. He also takes the storehouses. He plunders the treasuries of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Beit HaMelech, and of the king. And he takes all of the gold and gold-plated vessels, and he strips all the gold out of them. And like it had been prophesied, like Hashem had said when he's talking to Chizkiyahu, V'iglat kol Yerushalayim v'et kol hasarim v'et kol gibor ha'chayel aseret alafim goleh v'chol ha'charash v'hamazgel u'nishar zulat dalat am ha'aretz. And he denudes, he completely takes away out of Yerushalayim and out of that area of Yehuda, he takes all of the nobility, all of the upper classes. So he takes the officers and he takes the heroic leaders, he takes their 10,000 of them. So there are 10,000 of the problem, because another place it refers to different numbers, so I'm not going to get into the numbers, but he takes the nobility, the upper classes, the people with the power, the people with the skills, and he only leaves the Dalat Am Haaretz, the poorest of the common people, the poorest of the people. So this is a way, presumably, to avoid having them again rebel in the future. Suppose it va vayegel et Yehoyachin Bavel, and he exiles him to Bavel, vet Em HaMelech, vet Neshe HaMelech and his wives, vet Sarisa, vet Elei HaAretz, the noblemen of the land, Holich Golam Yerushalayim Bavel, and he takes them to Bavel. So Hecharash v'Hamazger, sorry, which is back in Pasuk Yudalid, Hecharash v'Hamazger, the simple, plain meaning is artisans and gatekeepers. But Chazal understood Hecharash v'Hamazger to be a reference to the great Torah scholars of the time. And the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Pechet, points out that the Pasuk Daniel says, Vayishkot Hashem al hara'a, Vayivieha aleinu, Ki tzadik Hashem elokeinu. Hashem was assiduous about the evil, about the bad, and he brings it upon us because Hashem is righteous. So the Gemara says, Hashem is righteous, that's why Hashem makes and does bad to us. So the Gemara says, El etzdaka asach kadosh baruch hu im Yisrael, Sheigla galut tzidkiyahu ve'adayin galut yichonyah kayemet. That he exiled the Jewish people under Tzidkiyahu, the exile which the Beit HaMikdash destroyed, and he does it in a quick enough way that this galut that we're reading about now, the galut of Yechoniah, which is Yehoyachin, it's another way of spelling it, writing it, another name for him, the galut of Yechoniah is still around, and they had Hecharash v'Hamazger, and they had these Torah scholars. So that's an interesting perspective in a couple of ways. First of all, it tells you that the understanding is that there were Torah scholars at the time and they were sent to Babel. And it looks back at Jewish history and says what we see is the beginning of the terrible disaster, the first exile, the first loss. And we had seen way back when that in the case of Malchut Yisrael, the northern kingdom, also there were multiple galuyot. So you might have imagined that this galut would have been a wake-up call. It would have been an opportunity for everybody to recognize that they were supposed to do, to change and try to do tshuva. So it might be that Hashem took away that option because we've seen that Hashem is now enacting the decree that came about in the time of Menashe because of all Menashe's sins. So maybe that wasn't a possibility anymore. But it's also that we find a certain amount of chesed in it because the fact that the next exile comes so quickly means that that exile will meet this generation. So we might have said in our prosaic, in our mundane ways, you might have said, well, it's good because they could show them the ropes of Bavel. It'd be almost like when one group of Jews came to America, they learned the ropes of business from the previous group sometimes. Sometimes the groups sort of help each other. And that's true of other immigrant communities. You know, that is why I think sociologists suggest that you find certain ethnicities taking over certain types of businesses. You know, why would it be that, if it's still true? There certainly was a time when, let's say, Chinese or Koreans were known for having laundries and dry cleaning businesses, or maybe Pakistanis and Indians have gas stations or whatever, things along those lines. And there are such stereotypes. They may just be stereotypes. But to some extent, there are truths to them, and the truth is that as an immigrant community comes, they have connections with each other in their community, and therefore they meet somebody they already know, and that person tells them about the business they've discovered as to how to do. So if I come to a new country, I have no idea what to do, and somebody I meet tells me, well, I have a gas station, and this is the way I make it work, then I can learn from him. I go to a new place, I find a gas station, and I build up the gas station, and I can make a go of it. And this might be true in many areas. So I could imagine that being the tzedakah, that just putting the galuyot together means that when the later golim, the later exiles came, they would have something. But of course, it's not only that. It is that we, in the traditional community, understand it to be a Torah aspect as well. And here what we're saying is that that galut involved most of, or the bulk of, the leading Torah scholars, which then would suggest that the people left behind have little Torah, and that might explain why they are unable to find tshuva, to find their way back to Torah, although this group didn't do that well in terms of spreading Torah among the people anyway, but it also explains why the odds were that much lower. There's another reference to this. There are 1,000 of them. All of whom are heroes who can make war. So the question is the war of Torah or is it the war of physical war, of military war? He brought them in exile to Bavel. So, Vayamlech Melech Bavel, Matanya Dodo Tachtam, Vayasevet Shemo, Tzidkiyahu. So, the king of Bavel puts Matanya, meaning Yoshiyahu had three sons, Yoshiyahu has really four sons, but three of the sons have been made king, right? The first one was Yehoahaz, made by the people. Then Paro Necho takes him out of the kingship, makes Yehoyakim. When Yehoyakim dies, his son becomes king, but then that son is taken off the kingship by Nebuchadnezzar, and then Tzidkiyahu comes to reign. So the number 21 of his age is a problem because it's not clear who Matanya is in the listing of Yehoiakim's sons. So one possibility is he was really older than his brothers. And the reason why he's referred to as being 21 is because Yoshiyahu made him king somewhat when his father was still alive, in the time of Yoshiyahu. That would already add a new twist to what's going on here, because that would mean then that Yoshiyahu made his son Tzidkiyahu king. And then when Yoshiyahu dies, instead of keeping Tzidkiyahu as king, giving him the rule that his father had wanted, now we see when the people make Yehoahaz king, it's not just that they've decided that he should be the king over an older brother, Yehoiakim, it's in the face of the wishes of Yoshiyahu. And that already suggests a theme that we've thought about before, that Yoshiyahu's ability to get the people under his, to follow his ways, was not as deep and was not as lasting as we would have liked it to have been. So that would give a new element to that. So that would be a possibility. That's what we mean by 21, by him being 21. And the possibility suggested by the Radak is that he's a different son. He's the youngest son. And therefore he, in fact, was 21 when he became the king. So Pasuk Yud-Tet, Vayasara b'nei Hashem k'chol asher asa Yehoiakim, and he follows the ways of his brother Yehoiakim. Ki al af Hashem hayta v'yushlam Yehuda ad hashlicho otam mi'al panav. And it was all because of the anger of God looking to get the Jews destroyed and thrown out of Eretz Israel, out of being in front of Hashem, right? Being in Yerushalayim in particular is Lifnei Hashem. So this is from getting rid of Malchut Yehuda. And as part of that, Tzidkiyahu rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. And that rebellion is what's going to lead to the downfall of Malchut Yehuda and to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So at this point, it seems like there's a loss of free will, and that's the way Rashi understands it. Rashi says it as Lefichach Vayimrod Tzidkiyahu Melech Bavel. That's why he rebelled. Natan Hakadosh Baruch Hu Belibo Limrod Kedei Sheyigle. Hashem gave him the thought that he should rebel, so that they would go into exile. So that already means that there's some loss of free will, as we mentioned before. It's also true. There's a pasuk in Mishlei that says Palgei Mayim Lev Melech Biyat Hashem, that Hashem controls the hearts of kings as the waves of water, and that would presumably be because kings have such an impact on human affairs that if Hashem is going to make sure that certain things do happen, certain things don't happen, then often the king's free will has to be limited in certain ways. But it can't completely be limited, because then we wouldn't be so thrilled with Yoshio for having done tshuva, because we would say, well, that's just Hashem acting in those ways. So it's sort of a balance that you have to think about. The question of free will and where it does come into play, where it doesn't come into play, how we do have it, how, when are we allowed to have it, and when we lose it. So those are important questions, certainly too complicated for our discussion, but important questions to think about and to struggle with. I'm not sure there is one particular answer, but it's worth thinking about and struggling with. Now, as we think about these two kingdoms, the kingdom of Yehoiakim, the reign of Yehoiakim, and the reign of Tzidkiyahu, about which we'll see a little bit more in the next parak, the final parak of Melachim Bet. But there's an interesting gemara in Sanhedrin which says, notes that Yirmiyahu refers to Bereshit Mamluchut Yehoiakim ben Yehoshiyahu. So the word Bereshit obviously reminds us of the first word of the Torah, the very beginning. So the gemara is bothered by, what do you mean by the Bereshit? There were no kings before this time? So the gemara says, sort of, that's sort of what Yirmiyahu seems to be implying. And it says, Ella, Bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lahachzir Et HaOlam Kulo L'Tohu Vavohu Bishvil Yehoiakim. God wanted to destroy the world, turn it back to Tohu Vavohu, put it back to the beginning, and start over, because of Yehoiakim. Meaning Yehoiakim was so evil that he wanted to do that. Istakel Bidoro, but he looks at the door of the generation, the people of Yehoiakim, V'Karira Da'ato, and Hashem decided not to. So that would make sense in terms of the fact that we say that soon after Yehoiakim passes away, so his son takes over, and it only rules for 3 months, and then he's taken into exile with Hecharash Ba'amazger, and there's 10,000 of them, or 7,000 of them, the numbers we've pointed out that we're not going to delve into. So that would suggest that what we mean by the door of Yehoiakim, that there were all these people who were good and Torah studiers, and things like that. Then the Gemara goes on, B'kidsh HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'achzir Et HaOlam Kulo L'Tohu V'Avohu, Bishvil Doro Shel Tzidkiyahu, but then the generation was already bad, and he wanted to destroy them. Nistakel b'Tzidkiyahu v'Karra Da'ato, and then he looked at Tzidkiyahu and refrained and was calmed down, is the literal way of reading it. So first, you notice that the Gemara seems to think the generations changed very quickly. That once you took away those 10,000 or those 7,000, when you took away those people, the Charash and the Mazker, that the people were left were in fact much more evil. They were much more likely to get involved in evil and problematic and wrong kinds of things. So that's one interesting aspect of that. And then the other aspect of it is that the Gemara seems to assume that Zedekiah was a good king, which would mean then, not only does he lose his free will because Hashem has decided to destroy Yerushalayim, and therefore Hashem compels him to be Moreid and Nebuchadnezzar, but the Gemara then also says, but Pasuk says, Vayasara b'nei Hashem. He says what's evil, so the Gemara says, Shayab b'yadolim chod v'lo micha. A theme we've seen before, that he had the ability to remonstrate with the people and to stop them from doing it, that he didn't have the power, he didn't have the strength of will to do so, and to stop them from what they were doing. So that portrayal of Tzidkiyahu is a complicated one. It's a disturbing one. It's a hard one for me to wrap my mind around, meaning that we think of Tzidkiyahu as being largely good. His fatal flaw seems to have been that he was unwilling to stop the people from what they wanted to do, and he gets them into an ill-fated rebellion because Hashem has decided whatever Hashem has decided. So in the coming days, when this group gets up into the book of Yirmiyahu, you'll want to think about when Yirmiyahu makes prophecies during the time of Tzidkiyahu, urging things like surrendering and going out to the Melech Bavel. So was there free will at that point to do that, had Tzidkiyahu wanted to? So it may be. And then why didn't Tzidkiyahu do it if he's a good king? It could be that he was so cowed by the people around him, he felt unable to do so. So all of that becomes questions to think about how the Gemara would understand these things and the role of Tzidkiyahu. But this idea that the people were good in the time of Yehoyakim, not good enough to turn things around, however, that Yehoyakim was so evil, even though we don't see what his evil was, that Hashem wanted to destroy the world. So it says a couple of things. It also says that the end of the Bayis Rishon, so there are many parallels between the creation of Beis HaMikdash and the creation of the world. So the end of that, the time when Hashem realized that he is going to let Nebuchadnezzar destroy the Beis HaMikdash, was a time when the fate of the world, to a certain extent, hung in the balance. And that the generation of Yehoyakim, who were the Charash and the Masgir, and who would set up the exile as being a place in which Torah would continue in some way, that saved that generation. And the figure of Tzidkiyahu, tragic as the Gemara seems to see him as being, having lost some free will because Hashem requires him to rebel against Bavel, and being unable to stand up to and to argue against the people who want to be evil in his time. So that's who Tzidkiyahu is. So that's all what's at play as we are on the verge of watching the destruction that will come in Perek Chaf Hei. So for now, we are left on the cusp of it. We don't have to get into it yet. We can leave that for yet one more day. Have a great day.